Titus. The book of Titus. You know, Paul sent Titus there to the city, to the island of Crete. It was a pagan place. It was a rough place. It was a place where people were gluttons and lazy and didn't really exhibit many of the qualities that church-going people would have. And so Titus is going to have a hard job. The book, we usually look at it and we think about it sort of a how-to book. How do you do this job? But as usual, when Paul writes, he undergirds everything with some big doctrine, some big truth. It gives you a place to stand and work to do. And that's what he's doing here with Titus. I want us to look at a few verses in the second chapter where he tells us about the big doctrine of grace and what God has done and is doing and will do for Titus as he is attempting to be a preacher in a community where maybe the gospel wouldn't be readily received. It would be one that would be slow going. I saw a missionary one time, and I believe it was Estonia, and I asked him, I said, how's it going? He said, it's just slug it out. Day to day, you just keep doing what you do. You keep planting, keep working, keep being where you're supposed to be, doing what you're supposed to be doing to get the results. Well, that's what he's telling Titus, and he's giving him all kinds of advice, but look at this big doctrine. We'll start with verse 11 and go through verse 15. He says, for the grace of God has appeared for the salvation of all men, training us to renounce irreligion and worldly passions and to live sober, upright, and godly lives in the world, awaiting our blessed hope, the appearing of the glory of our great God and Savior, Jesus Christ, who gave himself for us to redeem us from all iniquity and to purify for himself a people of his own who are zealous for good deeds. Declare these things, exhort and reprove with all authority, and let no one disregard you. So to a young preacher, old preacher, in a very short book, he takes time out of his instruction of how to appoint elders or deacons or some other things, and he goes to the heart of doctrine. There's certain things that are big doctrines, and they matter not only because they're true, but they matter because it's the foundation that we stand on. If you have good doctrine, if you believe the right things and really believe them, you have a better opportunity of being successful in your Christian life. If you don't, bad doctrine, you'll have everything else will fall apart as well. Look what he tells us, talking about the grace of God. In verse 11, he tells us the grace of God appeared to save us. Because that's what we're really talking about, isn't it? Salvation. We're talking about this thing that God has done with us and to us, this thing that we buy into when we become a Christian that radically transforms us. And the Bible word for that is salvation. It's as if we were drowning in a lake and someone pulled us out. It's as if the house was burning down and someone came in and got us. It's when the whole society is heading for hell and someone stands in our way and offers us the story of grace, that you don't have to go here. You don't have to be here. There is a better way. The creator of the universe loves you and he wants to have your fellowship. So he tells us the grace of God appeared to save us. That's the reason God did it. He could have just left this off and let us all be lost. He could have done that, but he couldn't because he loved us. And so he offers us this opportunity for us not to be lost. Then he tells us not only is the gospel or the grace of God is not limited to that once in our lifetime encounter with God when we decide that we believe him and we obey his commandments. He says grace is more than that. It's bigger than that. It's one of the things it does is save us, but it also trains us. It's grace that's behind any improvement we have in our life. Look what he tells us in verse 12. He says, the grace of God is here to train us. What's it training us to do? Well, he makes a whole list. I think there's like five of them. He says, to train us to renounce irreligion. I mean, when you read this letter, you feel like maybe Titus was in Dallas, you know, or maybe Titus lived in San Angelo, or maybe he was in California or something, wouldn't you? The world that he's dealing with and the things that Paul's talking about here sound just like the world we live in, doesn't it? And what he's telling us is grace is what's behind this training that changes us. Now, in other places, he would use a word like transform or this ongoing redemption, or John would talk about it as a cleansing that cleans us up and changes us. But this process that starts with us accepting the grace of God and obeying his commandments and buying into this thing of being a Christian doesn't stop there. He says that grace is what trains us to renounce irreligion. Now, religion by itself doesn't save anybody, but you have to put Christianity in some bin, and that's where you would find it. And the problem with most people isn't that they like this church better than that church. The problem is always that we don't really like God being in charge. And so we sometimes will even set up a structure of religion that's more after ourselves. That's more of what we like. And so then we can have it. If you like whatever, you can have whatever because it's your deal. Now, we get that from the culture we live in. We get it from our own selfish selves. You know the world we live in where you can have anything you want. If you don't like the phone company, fire them. Get another one. There's somebody else, another big company, would be glad to have you. Matter of fact, they will woo you and maybe give you a prize for coming over to them. If you don't like the utility company, you can fire them. Big old utility company, you can fire them. You can hire somebody else. If you want your hamburger a certain way, you can have it any way you want it. And if they don't fix it your way, you don't ever have to go back there. You can have whatever you want. And nobody can tell you different. And if you want a church that pours honey over your head and sings some song from Alabama, then you can find one or you can make one. The grace of God trains us to renounce this basic flaw that says that we're in charge. The grace of God, he says, trains us to renounce this kind of ungodliness, this kind of irreligion. And so he says, not only does it do that, and he takes it even deeper to the next level, when he says the grace of God is what's behind the training of us to renounce worldly passions. The fact that we're selfish, that's a worldly passion. The fact that we're put way too much attention into the sensual things, that's a worldly passion. The fact that we want what we want and we want it no matter what it costs anybody else, that's a worldly passion. It's how do we learn not to be that way? How do we become noble people? Well, it's the grace of God that helps train us to do that. It's the grace of God that gave us his word. It's the grace of God that gives us instruction. It's the grace of God that shows us his son so that we have a perfect pattern. And the grace of God trains us to renounce irreligion and trains us to renounce worldly passions. And for example, he said, it's the grace of God that trains us to live sober lives. That doesn't only mean not get drunk. It means that we're in control of our mind, that we're in control of ourselves, that we're serious about where we are and who we are and what we are. Most of the world is not serious. You can live a week and never have a serious thought, if you want to. You can live a lifetime and never make a serious decision. It's the grace of God that trains us to be sober, to be realistic, to be serious, and to be in control of our mind. It's the grace of God that trains us to live upright lives. Maybe you have a different word than upright, but upright is it's a good word. It means we're standing up and we're facing God. One of Sister Marlette's grandchildren made a little talk at the service Friday, and she said she was admiring some flowers that Marguerite had, and she really liked the roses and some of the other really pretty flowers, and said, Sister Marlette said, what about the sunflowers? She said, well, I don't particularly like them. She said, you should, because they stand tall, and they always face the sun. And that little girl had a sunflower that she laid on her grave. Well, she meant a different thing by the sun, you know, and she meant a different thing by standing tall, but you know what she was saying to her. She was saying being upright, being the people that stand. What's the difference between us and all the other creatures in the world? There's a couple of things. One of them is we stand up. And the other one is we're upright, or can be. Now, if we want to live like the world, if we want to live like animals, we can do that too. But it's the grace of God that trains us to be upright. It's the grace of God that trains us to tell the truth, to be compassionate, to be kind. It's the grace of God that trains us not to steal. The grace of God is what trains us not to desire someone else's property or someone else's wife. Trains us to be upright. And he takes it even further than just modifying our behavior. He said it's the grace of God that trains us to live godly lives, that we actually reflect his nature to others. Now, we'll never be what we ought to be. We're always a broken mirror that reflects dimly, but we can reflect. We can be better than we are, and it's the grace of God. When he was telling Titus how to find leaders that could lead churches in a pagan world, what did he say? You look for a guy that's a one-woman man. They're rare, but you find him, he'll be a good leader. You look for a guy that, and he goes down all of those wonderful qualities that he gives for the elders, and he was saying, this is what's going to fix this problem that you have. Because those people are upright. They stand up. They stand out. And they act like God. Not in that they have all power or know everything, but they're good. And you can't. You know, the first criticism of Christians, one of the first slanders of Christians is they called them Christians. Now, we take that as a compliment, but sometimes when they called them Christians, they used another word that had two letters different, and it meant goody people, like goody two-shoes. So instead of saying like Christ, they were these people who were too good to go do what we do. They were too good to participate. They had this air about them. Well, they misunderstood when they thought that about us, but what do we know for sure? They noticed. They noticed. They noticed that these people knew how to live not only upright lives, but godly lives. What they said and what they did was consistent. Their talk and their walk were the same. And it's the grace of God that enables us to do that. You know, there was a time when you couldn't do some of the things you do now. There were times when you couldn't live the way you live now. You remember a time, don't you, when the things you wanted, you don't want anymore. And the things you thought were so boring and such a waste, now you love it. What is it about that? Why are you here on Sunday night in a beautiful day like we have? The lake is still open. There's still stuff going on all over town. Why are you here? Because the grace of God has trained you. It's trained you to live godly lives, to seek to be in his presence. And then he says, he adds one more line to that. Look at that verse 12. he said, not only to renounce irreligion, renounce worldly passions, to live sober lives, to live upright lives, to live godly lives, he said, in this world. It's the grace of God that gives you enough energy, enough strength to not only be able to do these things, but you can do them out in public. You can do them where people can see you. You're in this world. We're not in a commune someplace or in a compound someplace with a big wall around it, but we're in the world. Tonight we're in worship, but we'll go home, and we're in the world. And it's the grace of God that trains us to be able to live in the world. You know there's pressure. You know there's other things being said to us. You know there's always the desire of the world for us to conform to the world, and you know we're not supposed to do that. How can you resist that? Well, it's the grace of God that teaches you that. Then look what he tells us in verse 13. He tells us that it's the grace of God because we wait in grace. As we wait for God, as we are patiently waiting for God to carry out the promises he's made, you know, because we live by faith and not by sight. That means we don't have all the stuff he's promised us. We don't have them now. We know they're coming, and we live as though we already have them, don't we? And it's the grace of God that enables us to do that. What did he tell us here in this verse? He says it's the grace of God that enables us to wait with hope. While we wait, we still believe. Abraham lives most of his life without any promises that God has made to him. The big three, they're never met. He never owns the great land. He never has the great family. He never sees the great promise. And yet he lived in hope. How could he do that? Because he also lived in grace. We live in hope, and we wait in hope. We know, because we believe what God said, and because God has given us his grace, we are able to survive with things still in the future. The promises are still there. God promises us that all things work together for good to them that love the Lord. That means that some stuff that you're living in right now is not good. The words are works together for good. How can you live through the junk you live through? How can you live through the suffering you live through? How can you live through the news you get? How can you get up in the morning? It's the grace of God that allows us to wait and hope. We really believe the end of the story is a good story. We really believe that God will come through. We really believe that he'll take care of us. We really believe on the last day we will be called to meet him in the air. We believe that, don't you? Why do you believe that? Because the grace of God has given you not only to save you and not only to help you live better lives, but the grace of God is an energy that God transfuses into you so that you know who you are, and your faith is coupled with his grace, and you're able to look ahead like Abraham did. It's the grace of God that allows us to wait for glory. Glory. We don't use that word near enough. Glory. The demonstration of God's true identity. And we wait for it. We see hints of it now, don't we? Here and there. We see it in some people. We see it in sunsets and sunrises. But we're waiting for glory. We're waiting to when the angels all become visible. We're waiting to see God in his true nature, not just glimpses of him. We're waiting to see the elements melt, and we're waiting to see the city that he's prepared for us. And we wait. Although now we can't always see it, we wait with glory because we wait with hope. We wait for it. And the reason for that, he tells us the third thing, is because we're waiting for Jesus. We know he's coming back. He promised us he would. And he never broke a promise. And some of them were incredible. 3 days I'll be alive again. And he did. And he said he's coming back. And so we wait for Jesus, the glory of Jesus. And we wait. This Jesus that we're waiting for, what do we think about him? This Jesus that we're waiting for is the one who gave himself for us. Look at verse 14. He gave himself for us. Who loves you like that? Make a list of the people that would take a slap for you. It's not going to be a lot of people on that list. How about the people that give an arm for you? There'll be less. How about somebody that'll give you every drop of blood he has, every square inch of skin that he's got, every ounce of decency he has about him? And he does it because you need all that. Who would give their life for you? Who would give their life for you that when you've never really done that much for him? Who would do that? Who would die for you before you ever said, I like you? Who would die for you before you ever said, I believe you? That's what he did. The gift that he gave, the grace that he offered, was enough for everybody. While we were still sinners, Christ came. We wait for the glorious Jesus who redeemed us, who gave himself for us. And he says, who redeemed us from what? Iniquity. There's some words that just go worse than just saying sin. Iniquity. What do you think about when you think of that word? It's like wicked, isn't it? It's one of those words that just, you have to put words like perverted with it, or words that just, it's an amplifier that says, we're not talking about you kept your library book too long. We're not talking about you went a little bit over the speed limit. We're talking about wicked. We're talking about dark things. We're talking about the thing that you hope nobody ever learns about. The thought, the act, the secret sin, the wickedness. We're talking about hatred. We're talking about perversions. We're talking about dark, mean, nasty things. And he redeemed us from it. He redeemed us from it. How do you ever get to be holy when you sin like that? It's grace. It's grace that it would even be offered. It's grace that God would carry through. One thing that we know when we're having trouble with our faith is sometimes we just, I remember one time a man, a member of this congregation, was dying. His hospice was there, and he was a good guy, a good guy. He was a kind man, and he liked to worship. But his wife called me one day and said, you need to come over here. It's not going well. And I go over there, and he's in there just wailing. Oh, he's wailing. And I went in there, and he said, I'm not good enough. I'm dying, and I've done awful things. I'm not good enough. I said, no, you're not. But thank God he is. My hope is built on nothing less than Jesus' blood and righteousness. Not my righteousness. His righteousness. That's grace. We've made a horrible mistake, a terrible mistake, to say to some denominations, you can have grace, we'll take obedience. It's not ours to give away. If it's true, it's true. And he says here, we wait for Jesus. The one we're waiting for is the one that redeemed us from iniquity. The one that redeemed us, what is the next thing he says? To purity. Well, how did he do that? That's part of that grace, is that refining method that takes place with us as he calls us out of the world and he makes us into people that look like him. If John was telling this, he would say, born not of the will of flesh or the will of man, but of God. There's something that happens when that person says yes to God and says, I don't want to live this way anymore. I'm not going to live this way anymore. I know that Jesus is the Son of God. They submit to baptism, and God works on, I don't know how he does it, but he works on us, and we get better. It's like if you took ore out of the ground and there's a little bit of gold in that ore and you go to work on it. It's a long process. It involves caustic chemicals and crushing, but mostly lots of heat. And what comes out of that is gold. What comes out of that is purity. And the better job they do with it, the purer it is. And that's what he does with us. In other places, he would describe it as a plant that the father, that the vine keeper snips on and prunes on and works on. But when he's through, he's got something, doesn't he? It's calling us out of one kind of a life and actually changing us. It's the prodigal's dad putting the coat on him and the ring on him and the shoes on him and gives him a bath and takes him to a party. It's changing him. That son that was dead is now alive again, and he's going to look like my son because I'm going to see to it. We wait for Jesus because he not only saves us or redeems us from iniquity, he doesn't just empty us out and now we're clean, but he makes us into something better. I've been here long enough, I've seen some of you get a lot better. I've seen some of you, you look so much more like Jesus. And I can't even see you with that kind of vision, but it's just obvious. There's something that happened. He said, that's why we wait. Now, how do you name that of what God has done? You call it grace. And like gold ore, he claims us and he refines us and he makes us into his image. Jesus, he said here, claims us for himself, his people, his purpose, for his good work. And then he tells us in verse 15 that God's grace is the very reason that we have this good work to do. He doesn't save us and purify us and clean us up and put us on a shelf somewhere as a trophy. I wish you'd have seen what he looked like before I got through with him. I wish you'd have seen how he was, but now he looks at him. He's not like someone that takes old cars and restores them and then parks them in a building someplace for people to look at. He restores us and purifies us so we can do his work. That's what he says. He says, but as for you, continue in what you have learned and have firmly believed. I'm in the wrong book, excuse me. The page turned on me. Timothy is also a really good book, but it's not the one we're looking at. He says, declare these things, exhort and reprove with all authority. Let no one disregard you. And in the last part of verse 14, he says, a people of his own who are zealous for good deeds. It would be enough if God just saved us. It would be more than enough that God would clean us up and purify us. It's even more than that. It's way over the top that he would claim us and own us and call us his own people. But to actually trust us with his work, to actually empower us to do the job that he has sent us here to do, to actually let us be his representative in Crete, for example, or in San Angelo. It's amazing grace. It's if he was calling his angels together and said, I need to send someone to your town, to San Angelo, you know the angels would all say, send me, send me. But no. He takes his people who are called by his name that he has saved, sanctified, and empowered to go to those dark places and say, over here, there's light. I know what you're going through. I used to do the same thing. I know who you are. I know all of this because this is where I belong. Remember Jesus did that? Remember that guy he found that was living in the graveyard, the naked man that was the wild man, remember, that had legions of demons in him? After he confronted him and cast the demons out and gave him back his mind and his dignity and everything, remember what the guy wanted to do? He said, let me go with you. And he said, no. What did he tell him? Go home to your own people and tell them what God has done for you. That's exactly what Paul is telling Titus here. He said, these people that God, through grace, has saved and sanctified and claimed, these people he has also commissioned. And he gives Titus a little taste of what his commission is. He said, declare these things. What things? Well, the things he's been talking about. Be God's man in this place. And reprove with all authority, exhort, do your job, you know what it is, and let no one disregard you. Let no one disregard you. Because the grace of God not only gives you a job to do, but he gives you the authority to carry that job out. That means that the things that God has commanded you to do, nobody can tell you you can't do them. They tried to tell the apostles, don't you preach anymore? They said, beat us up if you want to, but we're going to speak the things that we've seen and heard. If God calls you to teach the lost, no one can tell you you can't. No one. Now, maybe we can tell you that you can't teach in room 205 at 9 o'clock on Sunday morning or 9:30 on Sunday morning. But no one can tell you you can't teach lost people. If you have an opportunity to feed hungry people, feed them. Now, maybe you can't be the deacon in charge of benevolence. But no one can tell you you can't do this. That's what he's telling Titus. Doesn't matter what else happens. It doesn't matter how far along in the process other people are, or even if they're not along at all, you have your job. There are places where Christians are not allowed to own property. There are places where they're not allowed to have public assemblies. There are places where they're not allowed to put articles in the newspaper or on the radio. There are places where people throw them in jail if they catch them doing it. You know what they do? They do what God told them to do. Because what do you really need? A hole in the ground with some water in it, some unleavened bread, some grape juice. A Bible would certainly be nice. Maybe a song book. And what else? People who belong to God. And what do? They just keep preaching. They keep working. They keep changing. And people keep noticing. They know. Right now in Cuba, the church is bigger than it was when we left there because they were under difficult circumstances, just kept doing this very thing. And now they're kind of in favor. Everyone started noticing. You notice this little bunch of people over here, they never give us any trouble. You notice this little bunch of people over here, they feed hungry people. You know, they're making our life easier. It's easier to be the mayor of this town because these people are there. You notice these people, they always tell the truth. You never have to worry about that. Do you notice this group of people? We never arrest them for anything except praying. What is this with these people? And after a while, something starts clicking in even pagans' minds that something that's out of this world happened. True story. A little over a year ago, the church and some of their representatives went before the government authorities and asked for, I think, it was to pass out Bibles. They have to get permission for everything. And the lady that was in charge was a total believer in the old communist stuff. And she said, "You come every month and ask for this. You need to know this will never happen, ever. And you need to learn some discipline, and you need to learn some submission." And she just chewed on them and chewed on them. And one of the old preachers, he just steps back and bows his head and stands there with his head down. Finally, she said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm praying." "What are you praying? Or who are you praying to? And what are you praying?" "I'm praying to God, the creator of the universe. And I'm asking him to do something with you." You would think he'd be hauled out and thrown in jail. Instead, she got real nervous. She said, "We'll talk about this more later." And two things happened that month. One is she resigned from her post. Another person took that job. And the next month when they went in, he said, "I know there's been some confusion about this. And how many Bibles is it you want to give away? Are you selling these or what?" "No, no. You see our paper. We want to give them away." And they said, "How does 200,000 sound all right to you? Could you distribute that many?" And so a yes was there. Now, why did that happen? Grace of God, of course. The providence of God, of course. Neat things, of course. But also, it shows when we do what we are supposed to do, when we allow God to change us, holiness shows, purity shows, kindness shows. And also, there's something else he says here, knowing who we are. See, what that, I don't even know that lady, but what she knows is this is a man of God. And he's talking to God. And even atheists are scared of God. Why would they talk about him so much if they don't believe in him? Nobody has meetings say, "We need to do something about this growing feeling towards leprechauns." No one does that. But God, that's a different thing. And Paul is telling Titus, the grace of God will empower you. The grace of God will ransom you. The grace of God will change you. It will save you. It will clean you up. It will make you into something that's not only useful for yourself, but for God. It'll make you part of his family. You'll be called out of the world, but you're still in this place. But everyone knows that you are from somewhere else, that you are somebody else, and he'll give you work to do. Now, all of us fall short somewhere on these lines. Some of us have never been saved, and so we miss the whole thing. Some of us have never been redeemed from wickedness. Some of us are still practicing irreligion. Some of us have never given up the sins of our life. And although the grace is there, just like it was there before we became a Christian, it's there to redeem us and to cleanse us, but we haven't done it. And some of us have never boldly taken a hold of the gifts that God has given to us, the abilities that we have, and the work that he has for us to do. I think that instead of doing all of this with angels, God is showing his glory by using the weakest of his conscious thinking creatures to do this great thing. And it makes God look really good that he uses us dirty little people to do his work. That's the grace of God. And that's why Paul would finish this idea by saying, "Let no one disregard you. This is truth. And truth you can always stand on. Truth will always hold you up. Truth is always there. And so we're the people of God, true. But we're also the people who've been called by grace, redeemed by grace. And because of grace, we wait and hope. And while we're waiting, we're working. We're working. If there's something about grace that you haven't embraced and you haven't got a hold of, this is the time. Won't you come to Jesus while we stand and sing?